Welcome back to the Mob Mentality Show. I'm Austin Chadwick, and today we have the Chris's Squared with us. We have Chris Lucian and Chris Stead, and I'm really excited about today's show. One of my first introductions to mobbing was with Chris Stead, you know, so we visited people who mobbed, and he was one of the people mobbing, and we went out to lunch, and he was just really insightful, had a lot of great questions. And then I've been really privileged to be able to mob with him for about a year, and it was just a fantastic experience. So I'm really excited to have Chris Stead on the show today. So before we jump into our topics, Chris, would you like to introduce yourself a little bit?
Yeah. So I write software, and I mob. The biggest things for me are really centered around communication, collaboration, people treating other people like humans, and open source. I'm a big open source guy, and so those are kind of my life day in and day out when I'm not dealing with the child exploding our house. So.
we're all three of us are in that mode.
Yeah. Exactly.
So jumping into our first topic, all topics are humane mobbing, storytelling and code, and empty teacups. That's what's coming up. But let's go ahead and jump into humane mobbing. What comes to mind for this topic for you?
I warned you ahead of time. Humane development, right, is kind of that idea of focusing on people first, and so humane mobbing is going to be that same idea. It's how do we focus on the people first and make that an awesome experience, because that will bleed into the code. I mean, Conway's Law tells you that whatever your individual dynamic, whatever your company dynamic, and whatever that communication and collaboration structure looks like, it's going to influence the way that your code is structured and the way that it looks and reads. Jason Kearney and I had a big discussion at one point. We talked about basically emotion getting captured in code, right? So whatever your emotional state is, it will show in your code, and other people will feel it. So
I've definitely seen painful code before.
Yeah, and so, you know, that's something where the more that you focus on the people, the less that you're going to have this uncomfortable code where you're like, not only do I not know what to do with it, but I don't feel good reading it because somebody else was really uncomfortable while they were writing it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the really brief version.
Yeah. Nice, right on. So what, maybe it kind of strikes me a little bit. So what does uncomfortable code look like? You both kind of lit up when you said that. I'm like, oh, what is that?
For me, I mean, uncomfortable code, it's not even so much that it looks like anything. It's when you start reading it and you go, oh, you know, that feel. And it's not, ooh, this is bad. Somebody, you know, because there's this really like, who wrote this? This is garbage, man.
Yeah,
it's not that feeling. It's that feeling of like somebody, whoever was working on this was not comfortable.
Yeah. Or panic. I feel like the word panic, like if I read code and I'm like, you know, this person was under a tight deadline and was leaving comments behind that was like, need to change this later, or it just, you know, can't think about this now, but this is all I got, right?
Yeah.
Stuff like that. And then just kind of going spiraling down a hole of despair, maybe.
The well of despair.
It doesn't communicate well, or maybe it just, that to me, I think has a piece of it. But I think panic, like if you're feeling panic and you're writing code, that means that you've been told by somebody that you your job's at stake before, or if you can't deliver this thing or something like that, like where it's unsafe. When you're writing code while you feel unsafe, I think it's a really dangerous thing to be doing for both the code and for the individual, right?
Yeah,
it's a stress.
Yeah. For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, right on. And I guess what helps, you know, we were talking about humane development, right? So what helps create an environment where that person is not like that, you know, when they write the code, or the mob is like that when they write the code? So what are things in your experience, Chris Stead, that has led to that for you? So
one of the first most important things that I see in a mob that's successful at writing code that reflects positive emotion, or maybe even neutral emotion, right? Because like code, it's never going to reflect perfectly neutral emotion. But if you can get to a place where people kind of understand the problem space, they understand what success looks like. You know, this is what it's going to look like when the code is working. Yep. And this is what it looks like now with the with the application. And really we're looking at not what does the code look like when it's working, but what does the outcome look like? Mm-hmm. So the more that people can share that understanding, share the context around the problem, share the context around the problem space, or rather the solution space, and have some way to talk about it. Even I encourage people to capture their ideas outside of the conversation, right? Capture it in some sort of physical way, because then if somebody were to move out of that group and onto something else, and somebody were to shift in, they can then go and look at this, and even if it's not completely clear, they can start asking informed questions. What does this thing mean? You say this here, but I don't understand that. What is this concept? Why are we making this choice? I don't understand what the problem is. And so you can start to trigger that communication, because ultimately, the more that you have those conversations and the more that you have that collaboration, the better that your project is going to be. And I mean, Chris has heard me say this a few times. Austin, I don't know how many times I've said it to you. but I have this kind of like 70-30 rule in my head, or like 80-20, which is spend like 70 to 80% of your time collaborating, communicating, mm-hmm. focusing on the problem space, collaborating with the people that are stakeholders in the problem, that kind of thing. And only 20 to 30% of your time actually writing code.
Yeah.
Which of course I know that somebody's going to watch this and go, ah, and their hair's going to go on fire. But but when you do that, the code that you write is going to just be the necessary code.
Yeah.
And it's going to produce closer to what you really care about. Mm-hmm. It's going to remove that, like, well, we're going to hack this in, and I don't know if this even solves the problem, but let's see, like, does it explode? Right? And it's like, okay, well, but can we start saying, like, well, we know what the solution looks like, we know what the problem looks like now. And so that one technical does it explode thing now becomes a minor thing instead of like a major hurdle, right? So it's really centered around people working together, treating each other like humans.
So what jumps to mind for me practically is, okay, we're going to start a mob programming session and let's go. So the first thing is not write the first function. It's, hey, what problem are we solving?
Right.
Is the product owner in the mob? What problem are we solving? Card it out, whiteboard it out, event storming maybe, or something like it, you know, to say like, okay, here's the problem, here's our first thin vertical slice through the problem, and now that we have that high level, now I believe we can go into this tech stack and write a module that will do it, or something like that, right? Yeah, right. Yeah.
Third-party dependencies, all that stuff. Talking to the people you need to talk to.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the more that you can break that down into, I mean, even the user takes this one action.
Yeah.
The system then needs to respond in this way, in that one action.
Yeah.
Then you can start to really code that, right? Because if you start off with, well, we need to have this form, the user fills out the whole form, and then you know, you're never gonna solve that, right? That's too much.
It's not minimum viable. Yeah,
exactly. It doesn't satisfy lean. It doesn't satisfy, you know, this kind of humane behavior, this collaborative effort. It's just like, I'm gonna just like hammer, and I'm gonna try to keep all the context in my head and write. And as soon as you start trying to keep all the context in your head, you've got too much information to share.
Yep.
And as soon as you have more than about two people trying to share that information to a third person, fourth person, fifth person, it's too much. And so the channels bog down the communication. So you
building up context across that many people for everything. And so, you know, I recently talked to somebody about this idea of having kind of minimal context to move forward, minimum viable context, right? And mm-hmm. that's a more healthy behavior than I think people typically think, right?
Yeah.
And maybe this will segue us to the next topic is, if you do that first and you kind of have the domain established and the context set with the team, then it's much more simple to go into the code and name things, right?
Right.
And so that kind of jumps into storytelling in code, maybe, is instead of it being like, I don't know, this function that's going to do something, I don't know quite yet, you kind of jump in knowing like, okay, we're going to we have a pretty clear picture on what the domain is, so we can start naming it that kind of way.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And that, for me, at least leads to storytelling and code. So do you mind jumping in on what you think about that topic? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a really important part of it, right? Because you're basically building that context into your code. You're saying, this is what this code is about, mm-hmm. right? This is the problem that it's trying to solve, and this is the solution that we're affording for that that particular problem. And, you know, even if you get to this point where you're like, I understand most of the domain, but I don't understand what to call this, or I don't know yet, you know, Arlo has suggested, you know, okay, seven stages naming, and you just give it something. Yeah. And actually, it's interesting that it goes all the way back to, like, Eric Evans and Vernon Vaughn, is that his name? Yeah. Who are DDD guys, and they early on said, look, if you don't know what to call it, just call it anything and come back to it. Like, there's no harm in giving it a garbage name to start, and it's actually better to give it a name that means nothing than a name that means something but it's wrong, mm-hmm. right? Especially if you know it's wrong.
Yeah.
Right? If you don't know it's wrong, then you know you did the best you could. But if you know it's wrong, then don't give it that name. You know, give it something else. And that leads to, you know, ultimately, I think about source code not as this is the program we're writing, right? At worst. It's a technical specification, right? That's all it is. And it can be as muddy as you want, but it is for people, right? It is a specification. It's words. Language is devised. I mean, back in the 40s, right, when Grace Hopper invented the compiler, her reason for doing it was to write English and create a program, right? So that was her whole purpose. And we're now, you know, what, 70 to 80 years later, and that's, you know, we're still arguing over this. And it's like, no, source documents are for people. And so because they're documents, you can edit them like documents. And you can start thinking about it like a story or a book or an article. And refactoring stops being, I'm going to change behavior or not change behavior. And it becomes an editing process, right? Yep. I'm actually editing the source code with an editor's hat on. I'm not thinking about it like a programmer anymore. Yep. And so I'm trying to convey meaning. And so now all of a sudden your source code is really a meaning document, and that becomes your story. And your story has a beginning, a middle, and an end. In the beginning, there was a problem that a person had. And then in the middle, we had to do some work in order to solve that problem. And in the end, the problem was solved and the result was provided. Mm-hmm. Right? So you now have these little mini stories, and a large piece of software is going to have, it's going to be like a series of vignettes. Mm-hmm. And now all those vignettes kind of weave together to tell one bigger story.
Yeah. That's fantastic. I love that analogy because it really switches, especially I think if you adopt that metaphor or analogy, it changes the discussion quite a bit, because I think we're programmers and that's our title and we think about everything like code. Well, it looks like code. It looks like gibberish that most people don't understand, and that's okay because it's code. It's called code. It's not so, called, yeah. It's right. Not called, you know, but if you, like we say, you go back to the whole reason we have, so to speak, code, is it to make it read like English.
Right.
So no longer it becomes, hey, can you understand it? It's, does it read like English? Does it read like a story? Right. Can anyone read this? You know what I mean? Right. It'd be like someone writing a newspaper article and being like, well, it makes sense to me. I don't care if anybody else can read it. You know what I mean? So yeah, publish it, you know? So
works on my desk.
Yeah, yeah.
Software pros.
Yeah.
I mean, that's where I would love to be, as software pros.
Yeah.
You know, love it to be. I mean, I'm kind of in love with that Don Knuth, like, literate programming. I'm going to write what I mean, and then I'm going to put in, I mean, his idea was a little more like, you know, we ended up with LaTeX and that whole idea of, like, I've got a document, and in the middle I've got a program. But still, that same idea of, like, this is what I mean.
Nice. And what's the phrase you say? It's a... Go write the next great American...
Write the next great program, right? The next great American program, or if you're somewhere else, you know, the next great French, Swiss, Armenian, whatever program.
Yeah.
You know, think of it like a novel.
Yeah, that's excellent. Right on. Yeah. Well, I guess we can transition to the last topic. Yeah,
sure.
So, empty teacup. Are you thirsty? What is this about?
it's an explanation.
So... Empty teacup, it does kind of tie in with the rest of this stuff. It's that idea that when you're learning something, if you come in and your teacup is already full, you can't pour any more tea into it, right? Mm-hmm. You can't say, here, let me give you something new.
You can, it'll just spill over.
It'll spill over. Yeah, you won't absorb it. And so by starting off with an empty teacup, coming in and saying, I'm ready to receive what you have to offer, then it prepares you for a learning state. And so you can walk in and say, I want to know, I want to discover. When you go and talk to your product owner, I want to know what you need. I want to know what you know. I want to know what you're hoping for, what you're expecting. And same with your teammates, the same with anybody else you're going to interact with. You go in and you assume to start that you don't know what they know and that you're ready to receive what they know, then you're more likely to have success as far as building your software, having a conversation, collaborating well. All those things tie in with being open to hearing and learning what somebody else has to say and learning from their experience.
I think that's really interesting, because I mean, I think that it's probably extremely helpful perspective to take into any situation, whether you're entering a mob to start some work or a meeting or even a training. Because often, I thinking back, reflective today, I come into mobbing and I'm like, okay, I know where we left off yesterday and I have some ideas on where we're going to solve it. So it's almost like I have an idea, get ready to be inflicted with my idea. You know? Right.
Does everybody have an empty teacup?
Right? Yeah. And so where when I'm in that mode, I'm less likely to be like, oh yeah, explain to me what you mean by that. I'm kind of more like, and hopefully I'm not this way where I'm like disregarding people in the mob and saying like, we're just going to do my idea. Hopefully I still am like, oh, you have a different idea. Let's hear it out. Yeah. But I think it's probably harder to talk and act that way if you come in with like, here are my ideas, ready to receive them, as opposed to I'm entering the mob today, ready to learn from others. And I think even though it almost sounds like it's something for like an entry role mindset, it's almost like the more senior you get, the more you have this mindset, right? Yeah. Because the more you know you need to learn from others and the less you have the answer, right?
Yeah. And actually, you know, I've been, I wrote my first line of code professionally in 1996. And I would say within the last like handful of years, I finally figured out, hey, if you have an idea and you write it down, then you can empty out your teacup, right? Mm-hmm. You can actually empty that out and say, I've got an idea, but I'm going to set it over here. I'm not going to forget. Right. And so then you're actually now ready to receive feedback on it, to have that conversation.
That's Trello for me, for sure. Yeah. I'm constantly writing notes, and I'm like, I really need to remember this. And in the past, I'd be like, I really need to remember this, and this is all I can focus on because I can't forget it, and I'm going to tune out everything else because I have to remember this one thing. Right? And today, by contrast, I only keep it in my mind for 15 seconds, just enough time to get it down onto a Trello board or note paper or whatever. And then it's funny because then I can be very effective. I can take on more of these items. I create a Kanban board for myself, go one by one back through those, and then do whatever I intended to do with them from before. And so it's fascinating how much more effective you can be when doing something like that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And for me, emptying my teacup, case in point, I always have this with me, even at home. Yeah, yeah. So I'm an agile nerd through and through, as you can tell. But
no, that's awesome.
Whenever Austin walks anywhere, you see sticky notes flying off of him.
But literally, I'll be at home like, oh, I got to do that tomorrow. And I'll write it down and then I'll put it in a place, a Kanban board of sorts. Mm-hmm. Like maybe it's the my car on the steering wheel. Like when you get into work, do this thing. You know what I mean? You know, I'll put it there, and then I don't have to think about it. And I never thought about it that it empties the teacup. So I'm ready to be cognizant and present and with the people who are there, as opposed to trying to think about, remember this one thing.
there's like a mental baggage that you carry around with you, and it's like putting it down for a while and then coming back later to pick it up again.
That actually makes me think of one of my favorite things is to write a sticky, stick it there, and it'll sit there for a week, two weeks, and I finally go, and I throw it away. That was an idea, and I would have carried it around with me. I would have been thinking about it constantly until I did something about it. But then I realized that there were way more important things than that one thing that was weighing down my mind.
Throwing away those ideas, it's a lot easier to put it somewhere and stew on it for a little, or not even stew on it, don't think about it for a while, come back to it and be like, that wasn't a great idea, and then throw it away.
Yeah.
Where before you're like, this is super important. I really need to hang on to this.
Yes. Yes.
And it's kind of, there's another effect that I think is really funny is that, you know, you ever like walk away from your desk, like go to the bathroom or something, and like as soon as you go through the bathroom door, you forgot what you were doing.
Oh, yeah.
And then like by the time you come back out, you're like, I have no idea where I was going with that, everything. And so it's like that whole like walking through the doors, like crossing a threshold in general, kind of resets your brain. And this is a good way to make sure that you don't lose that context as well, because that reset can be so quick and it's a super strange phenomenon that I've mm-hmm. noticed over the years too.
Oh yeah, it's I was reading an article about it. There's been some study that's done. Been done on that effect, and it happens. But the interesting thing is that I've discovered if I go back and kind of retrace my steps, I can actually recapture that idea. I'm like, okay, so I walk through here, and so I kind of walk back where I was, and I walk back the same way again, and I go, oh, just to take it to the door. Oh my God, I remember. You know, it's
writing it down is a little bit easier.
way easier. Actually, that's why I carry. Like, I mean, even to here, I carried this thing, right? Because actually my weird little rocket book, which I think I've shown both of you now. It's this erasable notebook, but I can just like scribble whatever in here, and I don't feel bad just throwing every idea into it because, you know, I scan it, it goes up into my Dropbox, and then later if I decide I don't want it anymore, I just throw it away.
Yeah.
And it didn't waste any paper, it wasted very little energy.
Well, we'll link to that in the show notes, but I guess for everybody that's listening to this on the podcast, it is kind of a bound notebook, but it has pages with QR codes on it, and you can wash the pages, right?
Yeah,
like wash the pages, and then they come clean, but the QR code actually allows your phone to capture it and mm-hmm. digitize them very easily. So that's what a rocket book is, what you said?
Yeah, rocket book.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So, but yeah, it's a great permutation of those concepts.
It's actually, it's completely replaced carrying a laptop or a tablet or anything for me. Yes. I carry my phone and this, and so then, like, if I write something down, all I do is just scan it. It goes to Dropbox, and I go back to whatever I was doing. And it's not even like I need to worry about digitizing.
I feel like
it.
I capture a lot more of my sketches at that point.
Oh, yeah. Well, there are various different modes.
That's cool.
I'm not a rocket book salesperson, although if you asked some people that I've talked to, they'd probably say yes.
Yeah, fairly convincing.
So I guess maybe the one last thing before we close out. Just knowing you and working with you and talking with you a bunch, I know you're really passionate about education and learning, and I think this ties into the MTT Cup kind of thing. I mean, you teach programming to students of some kind, right? Code camps or something like that?
Yeah. I work for, I'm not going to name the place just to kind of keep it out of here as well, but I do work for a company that does boot camps, and they partner with universities, so it's all university extension stuff. Right now I'm doing a remote thing, and you know, I love working with students in person. It's awesome. You build these really strong interpersonal relationships with them. Mm-hmm. But honestly, doing a remote has been so nice. Because I go home, and when I'm done, well, because I was driving down to UCSD.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So it would take me an hour in the evenings to get home. So I'd finish up class at 10. I'd be home by 11 or 11:30.
Yeah, that's rough. That's hard.
And now, I mean, I'm teaching class that's out of Utah, so I'm done by 9.
Yeah.
And I close my laptop and walk out of the den, and I'm home. So I'm home by 9, which is fantastic.
Oh, that's much nicer, yeah. And I think about, and I'm sure you've seen this as a teacher, students mm-hmm. who walk in with the empty teacup and those who don't, right?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And it's, I think if you come, it's almost like something you need to do to get the most out of any training or class, right? Is, because if you come in with an agenda, you're likely to be filtering out things that would be valuable, mm-hmm. maybe you weren't even looking for in the class, right? And so, mm-hmm. to kind of, I don't know what the reminder would be for me to remember to do this, but when I enter a space or a training or class, to empty the teacup to receive everything from the class, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Because, I don't know, we've talked about it before, some people kind of enter training with a very strict agenda, ready to filter out anything other than their one actionable thing, right?
Right.
And I think if you do that, you'll probably be efficient in learning that one thing, but you may take the risk of not growing as a person in ways you didn't expect.
Sure.
So I'm just kind of throwing out my opinion there.
So you're right. The thing that I've noticed, though, is often people don't come, even if they come with an agenda, their agenda is usually not based in some sort of technical knowledge. Usually they come in with something emotional.
Mm.
It's almost always, I need this because X. I have to learn this now because Y. And so some students let that really impair their ability to learn. And it's something where I can talk to them all day long and say, don't worry about that. Don't concern yourself with whether or not you're measuring somebody else. Don't fuss over that stuff. Instead, focus on, did you learn something today that you didn't know yesterday? And remember that learning doesn't happen on a schedule. So just because one person learned something today and you didn't because you needed time to digest it, it doesn't mean that you're not going to learn it. It just means that they had something in their past that they could link this idea to that made it faster and easier for them to accept that information.
Yep.
But there are students that that I've run into who, you know, like because it's a boot camp, they're like, I need to learn, I have to go get a new job, I am stressed out and I am dying. And I'm like, okay, I understand that you're stressed and I understand why you're stressed, but you've got to let some of that go.
Yep.
Because you're not going to absorb while you're worried about the stressors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
And it's just stress in general. Like, that's probably the humane code as well, right? Mm-hmm. Is that you're just like your code will suffer, your learning experience will suffer as well, right?
Yes, absolutely.
You know, it's funny. The tie-in between education and Agile is sometimes pretty scarily cool. My wife were at an education conference, and I don't know if the person up speaking was married to someone who's an engineer,
mm-hmm.
but the speaker basically said, like, when you are teaching, have a minimum viable day, and,
right.
and it was talking about your learning and growth path, and to not schedule it out with right. estimates and all
yeah.
this stuff. So it was basically like no estimates,
yeah.
Kanban. You know, one thing at a time, you can only absorb so much at a time, so absorb that one thing and then move on to the next. If you stretch someone too far, they won't get anything. And so,
right.
and so it was kind of this cool moment where I was just like, oh, wow, it's like they're saying the same thing, but,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
from an education standpoint. And
absolutely.
Which sounds like, hey, why are we talking about education on a product development show? But this ties into so much to making an innovative product.
Yeah.
If you're not learning, you're probably not innovating, right? And so
even if you're not building something that would be quote unquote innovative, right? Let's
yeah.
let's say you're building the 93rd spreadsheet application, right? you can't assume that you know everything just because somebody else has built it.
Yep.
Yeah.
There's going to be some reason that you're building this one that's different than the ones that already exist. Why are you building a new one when you know that something already exists? And the answer is probably, I need something different.
Yep.
And so because you need something different, there are things to learn. And so within that, it may not seem innovative, but it's still going to be something new.
You still need to learn, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, most definitely. Cool. Well, I think we're out of time, Box.
Yeah.
Anything you want to end with, Chris, before we... you know, like a link to your Twitter or any other things?
Well, I think we should talk a little bit
sure.
about just the open source projects you maintain.
Oh.
and just be, you know, just to but maybe, I guess, I know you have many different open source projects.
Mm-hmm.
What are your top three?
My favorite children.
Yes. Which children are your favorite?
Don't tell me. I won't tell the other ones. Okay.
So there are a lot of people that are putting in issues that would probably argue right now that it doesn't seem like my favorite child, but JS Refactor is one that's definitely a favorite child
JS
of mine.
JS Refactor, all right.
I've been working on it for a long time, and it means
yeah.
a lot to me. Deject, I've been building something without it, and it's just painful.
and I've used Deject in two or three different projects and mobs now. It is amazing. So
thank you.
Yeah.
Very kind of you. And then Signet is one that I've really had a deep love for. The only reason why I pause on that is just because I haven't done anything to update it in a while because there's nothing to update.
Sure.
So it kind of feels like it's just like furniture now. So I'm kind of taking it for granted.
Okay.
And maybe it just needs, maybe I need to go and do something just to kind of give it a little bit of love to kind of rekindle that flame.
Alright.
So yeah, those are my three.
So JS Refactor is a refactoring tool for
mm-hmm.
JavaScript.
Yes.
Deject is dependency injection in
right.
JavaScript, right? And
mm-hmm.
then Signet is type safety at runtime for JavaScript, right? So check those out. I think all three of those libraries are really awesome, and Chris has a lot of other really cool software out there. So we'll link to the GitHub in the show notes.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It was awesome.
All right.
And Chris is also really great to follow on Twitter. He's got a lot of great thoughts throughout the day. So we'll put a link to his Twitter account as well. So.
Or I just spam your account.
I'm
going to apologize in advance.
That's the beauty of Twitter. At will, right? thank you. Be sure to share this video if you think it'll help anyone that you interact with, and like and subscribe, and we'll talk to y'all later.
Share, like, and subscribe.
Yeah.